If it's ever occurred to you what a curious idiom we use when we're describing, talking about what we do in Buddhism, we always use the word path, and the Noble Eightfold Path and so on. And we've used the word so often that it becomes a sort of a worn down metaphor. Just a piece of spare change in our linguistic vocabulary. And we don't kind of notice it, but it's actually quite a curious metaphor, I think. I wonder how deep it goes as a metaphor. I don't know whether anybody used that metaphor before the Buddha did. Research it would be interesting to see. For us, it doesn't sound like a metaphor anymore. It's been so worn down. This idea of the journey, of course, taking its cue from the much older story of the hero's journey. And there's a voyage from one place to another to gain something, bring it back and integrate it. And one of the dangers, I think, that we can fall into, because we forget that the word path is just a metaphor. And so it's easy to lose sight of what the metaphor actually means and how it's meant to be applied, and more importantly perhaps, how it doesn't apply. Because a path is something where you set out from your front door and you walk along the road and you get somewhere. And although the road might be difficult, it might be strange, it might be uncertain, and all of those things, but still it's a fairly straightforward process, one step after another, and you get where you're going. So if Chandra's driving and I'm directing, then that process might take a little bit longer and be a little bit more circuitous than otherwise. But still, eventually we get there. The spiritual path is not really like that very much though, is it? In some ways it is, but in other ways it's quite unlike that. And the metaphor of a path sort of perhaps gives an overly clear-cut or overly simplistic picture of what it is that we're actually doing. That's why I think in some of the later Buddhism, and then they have this idea of no path. And when you see these kinds of teachings, it's not meaning to say that, you know, the Eightfold Path isn't true, and you know, you should throw these things out or anything like that. What these teachings are doing is they're questioning how we use the word path, questioning how, what assumptions we bring to it, and questioning what actually is the reality of our practice, trying to get past the worn out coinage of the language that we use to describe the path. I wanted to talk this evening a little about the very important notions of Buddhism we call the three characteristics, anicca, dukkha, anatta. And I wanted to bring these in the context of the path, because in a way the teachings of anicca, dukkha, anatta cut across any notion of a sort of a progressive, simplistic step-by-step development of a path. Because of course the reality is that things are always impermanent. At the start of the path, the middle of the path, the end of the path. The things are always dukkha, always suffering at the start, the middle and the end. Anatta, always not self, at the start, the middle and the end. These aren't things that, you know, you can say, for example, in developing samadhi, you can sort of go from a state of having no samadhi and gradually developing it and having more and more samadhi until it's completed. And so that's, you know, quite like a path is. But anicca, dukkha, anatta is not really like that. It's always present in its fullness. It's always complete. Of course, our perception of it isn't always complete. Our understanding of anicca and dukkha anatta is not complete, and that develops. But the thing itself is always there. So it's like a counter current to that notion of a path. Because one of the things that, you know, I see as a teacher is that where people are at is so very different. And again, this is, in a way, is quite different from the notion of a path. You know, if we say, I'm going to go on a path from Santi to Vandenoon, well, you know, we're all going to walk down pretty much the same road, assuming we take the road and not don't cut through the bush and we go through that way. We'll see pretty much the same kinds of things. And we, of course, we'll have different experiences along the way. We'll have different thoughts. We'll have different emotions. We'll notice different things. We'll take a different speed. But it still recognizably is pretty much a shared experience. Whereas when I talk to people about their meditation and so on, it seems so often that things are so completely different for different people, depending on where they're coming from, what their background is, you know, how long, where they are in their practice, and all of these kinds of things. There's this huge kind of randomness to it. And so that's reminding us and warning us that we have to take and apply these teachings on the path and other teachings very carefully. We have to have a lot of respect for context. And if we just apply the same teaching in a kind of very kind of uniform way, it's not going to work. It's just not appropriate. But this is very much what the notion of impermanence is about. Very famously, in Thailand, when they translate impermanence, they usually use the word mai tiang, literally means impermanence. But Ajahn Chah always preferred to say mai nair, which means not certain. It's a slightly different take on the word impermanence. Not certain, or maybe not. It's not a sure thing. It's not a sure thing. So, wherever we are at in our practice, it's also not a sure thing. What's happening right now? Well, it's not a sure thing. We think that we can be aware of the present moment. We think there's like a kind of bare awareness. This phrase, I don't like this phrase, bare awareness. I think it's misleading. I think the very nature of the phrase bare awareness is betraying the falsity of the concept itself. There's no such thing as bare awareness. Awareness is always directed. Attention is always selective. Perception is always at work, interpreting. It makes us look at one side of things and not the other. It colours our vision in one way or another, and it's always doing that. And as soon as we say we're doing what they call bare attention, you're like imposing this concept that there can be an attention that's without all of those things. But that's just another layer of concept, which is pretending that it's no concept, and which disguises the way that you're actually selecting, shifting, paying attention, interpreting. So the real practice of awareness is not really bare attention. But that's why, like sampajanya, you can translate as contextual, if you like, contextual attention or contextual understanding. So it's not having an awareness that has no perception or attention or selection or interpretation. It's being fully aware of how we are interpreting, perceiving, selecting, directing attention. Being aware of that process as it's happening. And of course, this is one of the aspects of these things, anicca, dukkha, anatta, impermanent suffering and not self. Because everything that we feel, everything that we think, every idea that we have, every intention, every emotion, every memory, every plan that we have, every dream that we dream, every regret that pains us in our heart, every grief which is inconsolable and we feel that we will never be able to overcome. All of these things are anicca, dukkha, anatta. They're all impermanent. They change. They weren't there before and then they came to be because of causes and conditions and they will cease. Nothing surer than that. And they're suffering. Whether they're happy or sad, good or evil, welcome or unwelcome, they're suffering. They take effort to maintain them. consciousness takes effort, it's work, it takes energy. If we take all our energy out of our brain, we die. Simple as that. Constant energy is required. So we were talking a bit earlier about this notion of the reflection on food. And this is one of the reflections about the reflection on food or the reflection on nutriment, is that when we eat, you know, we have this idiom in English we call about brain food. You know, people advertise, you know, if you eat such and such a breakfast cereal, then, you know, give it to the kids and then they'll go off and they'll be much smarter when they go to school and remember their lessons better. Well, in a sense, it's true enough, isn't it? Our brains depend on food. Actually, this was something which was talked about in one of the Upanishads, even before the Buddha. One of the Brahmin students did an experiment where he fasted, went without food for many days, and then he couldn't remember the mantras, the Vedic mantras, because his mind was too weak, was too feeble. And then after he ate and regained his strength, he could remember them again. And so that's, you can see that's an empirical experiment, psychological experiment on the dependence of mental functions, particularly in that case memory, and food. So the fact that things are dependent on food and dependent on all kinds of other conditions means that they're dukkha, they're suffering, it takes work to sustain them. You can't just let them be and then expect them to just, you know, sustain themselves. Things don't work like that. And things are anatta, they're not self, because we can't control them, because they have no essence. So the notion of atta, or the notion of self, is basically comes down to this notion of, do things exist in and of themselves? Do they have their own, are things able to be self-reliant? And the reality, of course, is that no, they aren't. Things exist only in relation to other things. Everything is always conditioned by other things. And so any kind of notion of a self, an individual underlying entity, always falls flat. So when we talk about a self in Buddhism, all we mean is that there's a if you like, we can use the word node, a node of conditions, which is sort of where a bunch of things come together, and there's a degree of relative consistency and organization and persistence in there. And that's what we call a self, just for convenience's sake. And as we were talking about earlier, that when we take food or something like that, you know, you think that, you know, that if you look at the food we eat, we sort of, food existed a long time before it came in contact with us. And then it sort of comes out of the ground into the air, it's harvested, into the shed or whatever, it's put on a truck, it's taken to a sorting facility. All of these processes the food goes through, and at the end of that long journey, incredible number of causes and conditions that have to come together. The weather, the climate, the soil, all of these things. And finally it ends up in our mouth. Chomped and destroyed in a couple of seconds. Swallowed, covered in slime and acid in the stomach. Excreted the next day, flushed down the loo, into the sewage, and then back into the soil and then around again. So all of these things which are a part of us, except we're just like a node, we're just a stop along the way for all of this matter going through us, moving through us. And what we call a self, who we are, is just a relatively somewhat stable and somewhat well organized and somewhat integrated node in this web of conditions. So when we stop thinking of a spiritual practice as a path, and look at so rather than looking at it in an extended sense, we kind of slice through and look at the anatomy of what's actually happening right now, then we see this anicca dukkha anatta. We see the impermanence, we see the suffering, we see the not-self. And it doesn't matter where we are in our path, whether we're just starting out, whether we're in the middle of it somewhere, whether we're at the end of the path. Things are always just as impermanent, just as much suffering, just as much not self. So one of the secrets in Buddhism is that this perception and this understanding is actually a great relief, because our normal perception of the permanence of things, perception of the satisfaction of things, the perception of the selfhood of things, these are all delusory perceptions, and because they're delusory, they take like an extra layer of work to maintain. So to convince ourselves that something's permanent, there's like an extra work that the mind of moha, the mind of delusion, has to actually come into play and hide the impermanence of things, the imperfection of things, so that we can stay comfortable in our illusion of permanence. And so we do that. Just an obvious example is with our own bodies. Shifting and changing the way that we perceive our own bodies in order to meet our own expectations. And as we know, when that, you know, normally that happens within a, there's a kind of a degree that we do that. And that perception can sometimes get pathological, as we know with cases, for example, of people with bulimia. These kinds of things where you have a perception of your body as being fat or overweight, and yet to everybody else it seems abnormally skinny. So our own inner perception of our body is distorted. And of course that's where that distortion comes to a pathological degree, but for all of us it happens to some degree or other. And it can be in a positive sense and it can be in a negative sense. We can see ourselves as, you know, unattractive or fat or something like that. Or we can see ourselves as more attractive than we are or whatever. But whichever way it goes is not such a fundamental issue. The more important issue is the fact that it does, that we are shifting and changing our perception. And the same thing applies for all external objects and so on as well. And the more that we're attracted to, the more we're attached to things, the more we do that. You know, and kind of a great example is mothers with their children. You know, and to a mother, their own child is always the most beautiful child in the world. To everyone else, well, it's just a kid, just another kid. It doesn't seem any different. And so that's that shift in perception, creating those illusions and of permanence, satisfactoriness, and selfhood. Selfhood's not a good word, it's a better word. Identity. So because that's so much work to maintain that, it's actually a complex task to maintain that delusion. So we, in a way, we think of spiritual practice and the spiritual path as doing work. We think that we have things to do and a journey to go, and that's what this metaphor of a path is implying, is what it's teaching us. We have to actually work, put forth energy to get from one place to another. But from this other perspective that I'm talking about this evening, that the perception of anicca dukkha anatta, the reality of anicca dukkha anatta, is there already. It's surrounding us. It's the ocean that we swim in. We don't actually have to do any work to perceive it. We just have to stop doing that work of deceiving ourselves. It's the reality which is beating down the door. It's the ocean which is washing up against the dike. We just have to let it in. And this is where I believe, this is where the meaning of the verse that I recited at the beginning of the talk this evening comes in. And of course this is the very famous verse which was recited at the Buddha's funeral. Anicca sankhara, alas, all sankharas are impermanent. Upadavaya dhammino, their nature is to rise and fall. Upadhitva nirujhante, having arisen they pass away. Te sanghupasamo sukho, their passing is bliss, or their stilling is bliss. So this is, I think, one of the most important insights in Buddhism, and yet an insight which is rarely expressed with such clarity. And it's curious and a little bit ironic that this verse is actually recited at funerals, very typically in Buddhist countries, because it's not really meant to be for funerals generally. The point here is that this is the passing away of the Buddha. So his sankharas, his khandhas, cease. And that cessation of khandhas at parinibbana, te sang vu pasamo sukho, is bliss. Of course, for most of us, when we die, well, the khandhas don't cease, but they just transform or move on. And so that te sang vu pasamo doesn't really apply in the same way. And it's almost a bit strange, I always feel, that we're at a funeral and everyone's crying and sad and upset, and then all the monks are up the front saying, oh, it's so good to see that this bunch of khandhas has finished. So, anyway. So this is one of the truths which I think is only really apparent when our insight becomes quite deep. And you realize, the impermanence of things actually is very beautiful. The ending of things. You realize that the more things end, the more beautiful it is. And we stop having to create these defensive walls of permanence, happiness, and identity to try to hold the reality out. I think this is the important thing to recognize, that these walls are coping mechanisms. In a sense, it's just another way of these kind of perceptions is really what the psychologists would call the ordinary coping mechanisms or strategies that we use for getting by. And it's important to recognize that they do actually help us cope. The perception of permanence, of satisfactoriness and identity, they actually do help us cope at a certain level. But they're also, in a certain way, at a deeper sense, they're ultimately illusory, and we have to let go of them. So we have this fear that if we let these perceptions in, that somehow it'll be destructive. And if we're not ready for it, that may be the case. Yeah, so these contemplations are very powerful, and they can be very disturbing if we're not ready for them. But when we are ready for them, when we do let them in, and we can assimilate them and take them on board, they become extremely powerful. And we see, just that letting go, that not having to feel this compulsion, this need to spin everything, to create an inner narrative to sort of justify yourself all the time. Just to recognize, well, it's not sure. Yeah, of course it's unsatisfactory. That's what the world is. Of course it's not me or mine. There's no such thing as me or mine. And to feel the sense of relief that you don't have to insist on these things anymore. And when we let down those walls, those boundaries, we allow reality to come in and we can accept it. And this is that stilling which is very blissful. Not having to do that work to maintain those delusions. So this is my talk for you this evening on the path and on anicca, dukkha, anatta. I offer this for your reflection. Questions.